Arby looked and watched the whip-like tails swing back and forth over the younger animals. "I get it," Arby said. "They use their tails for defense, and they need long necks to counterbalance the long tails. It's like a suspension bridge." Levine squinted at Arby. "You did that very fast," he said. Thorn turned away, hiding a smile. "But I'm right," Arby said. "Yes," Levine said. "Your view is essentially correct. Long necks exist because the long tails exist. It's a different situation in theropods, which stand on two legs. But in quadrupeds, there needs to be a counterbalance for the long tail, or the animal would simply tip over." Malcolm said, "Actually, there is something much more puzzling about this apatosaur herd." "Oh?" Levine said. "What's that?" "There are no true adults," Malcolm said. "Those animals we see are very large by our standards. But in fact, none of them has attained full adult size. I find that perplexing."
"Do you?"
"It doesn't trouble me in the least," Levine said. "Unquestionably, it is simply because they haven't had enough time to reach maturity. I'm sure apatosaurs grow more slowly than the other dinosaurs. After all, large mammals, like elephants, grow more slowly than small ones." Malcolm shook his head. "That's not the explanation," he said.
"Oh?
Then what?" "Keep looking," Malcolm said, pointing out over the plain. "It's really rather obvious." The kids giggled. Levine gave a little shiver of displeasure. "What is obvious to me," he said, "is that none of the species appear to have attained full adulthood. The triceratops, the apatosaurs, even the pterosaurs are a bit smaller than one would expect. This argues for a consistent factor, some element of diet, the effects of confinement on a small island, perhaps even the way they were engineered. But I don't consider it particularly remarkable or worrisome."
"Maybe you're right," Malcolm said.
"And then again, maybe you're not."
Puerto Cortez.
"No flights?" Sarah Harding said.
"What do you mean there are no flights?"
It was 11 o'clock in the morning. Harding had been flying for the last 15 hours, much of it spent on a U.S. military transport that she'd caught from Nairobi to Dallas. She was exhausted. Her skin felt grimy. She needed a shower and a change of clothes. Instead, she found herself arguing with this very stubborn official in a ratty little town on the west coast of Costa Rica. Outside, the rain had stopped, but the sky was still gray, with low-hanging clouds over the deserted airfield.
"I am sorry," Rodriguez said. "No flights can be arranged."
"But what about the helicopter that took the men earlier?"
"There is a helicopter, yes."
"Where is it?"
"The helicopter is not here."
"I can see that, but where is it?"
Rodriguez spread his hands.
"It has gone to San Cristobal."
"When will it be back?"
"I do not know. I think tomorrow, or perhaps the day after."
"Señor Rodriguez," she said firmly, "I must get to that island today."
"I understand your wish," Rodriguez said, "but I cannot do anything to help this."
"What do you suggest?"
Rodriguez shrugged.
"I could not make a suggestion."
"Is there a boat that will take me?"
"I do not know of a boat."
"This is a harbor," Harding said. She pointed out the window. "I see all sorts of boats out there."
"I know, but I do not believe one will go to the islands. The weather is not so favorable."
"But if I were to go down to..."
"Yes, of course."
Rodriguez sighed.
"Of course, you may ask."
Which was how she found herself, shortly after 11 o'clock on a rainy morning, walking down the rickety wooden dock with her backpack on her shoulder. Four boats were tied up to the dock, which smelled strongly of fish. But all the boats seemed to be deserted. All the activity was at the far end of the dock, where a much larger boat was tied up. Beside the boat, a red Jeep Wrangler was being strapped for loading, along with several large steel drums and wooden crates of supplies. She admired the car in passing. It had been specially modified, enlarged to the size of the Land Rover Defender, the most desirable of all field vehicles. Changing this Jeep must have been an expensive alteration, she thought, only for researchers with lots of money. Standing on the dock, a pair of Americans in wide-brimmed sun hats were shouting and pointing as the Jeep lifted lopsidedly into the air and was swung onto the deck of the boat with an ancient crane. She heard one of the men shout, "Careful! Careful!" as the Jeep thudded down hard on the wooden deck. "Damn it, be careful!" Several workmen began to carry the boxes onto the ship. The crane swung back to pick up the steel drums. Harding went over to the nearest man and said politely, "Excuse me, but I wonder if you could help me." The man glanced at her. He was medium height, with reddish skin and bland features. He looked awkward in new khaki safari clothes. His manner was preoccupied and tense. "I'm busy now," he said, and turned away. "Manuel, watch it! That's sensitive equipment!" "I'm sorry to bother you," she continued, "but my name is Sarah Harding, and I'm trying..." "I don't care if you're Sarah Bernhardt, the..." "Manuel! Damn it!" The man waved his arms. "You there! Yes, you! Hold that box upright!" "I'm trying to get to Isla Sorna," she said, finishing. At this, the man's entire demeanor changed. He turned back to her slowly. "Isla Sorna," he said. "You're not associated with Dr. Levine by any chance, are you?"
"Yes, I am."
"Well, I'll be damned," he said, suddenly breaking into a warm smile. "What do you know?" He extended his hand. "I'm Lou Dodgson from the Biosyn Corporation back in Cupertino. This is my associate, Howard King." "Hi," the other man said, nodding. Howard King was younger and taller than Dodgson, and he was handsome in a clean-cut California way. Sarah recognized his type. A classic beta male animal, subservient to the core. And there was something odd about his behavior toward her. He moved a little away and seemed as uncomfortable around her as Dodgson now seemed friendly. "And up there," Dodgson continued, pointing onto the deck, "is our third, George Basilton." Harding saw a heavy-set man on the deck, bent over the boxes as they came on board. His shirt sleeves were soaked in sweat. She said, "Are you all friends of Richard?" "We're on our way over to see him right now," Dodgson said, "to help him out." He hesitated, frowning at her. "But, he didn't tell us about you." She was suddenly aware then of how she must appear to him. A short woman in her 30s, wearing a rumpled shirt, khaki shorts, and heavy boots. Her clothes dirty, her hair unkempt after all the flights. She said, "I know Richard through Ian Malcolm. Ian and I are old friends." "I see." He continued to stare at her, as if he was unsure of her in some way. She felt compelled to explain. "I've been in Africa. I decided to come here at the last minute," she said. "Doc Thorne called me."
"Oh, of course. Doc."
The man nodded and seemed to relax, as if everything now made sense to him. She said, "Is Richard all right?"
"Well, I certainly hope so, because we're taking all this equipment to him."
"You're going to Sorna now?"
"We are, if this weather holds," Dodgson said, glancing at the sky. "We should be ready to go in 5 or 10 minutes. "You know, you're welcome to join us if you need a ride," he said cheerfully. "We could use the company. Where's your stuff?"
I've only got this, she said, lifting her small backpack. Traveling light, huh? Well, good, Miss Harding. Welcome to the party. He seemed entirely open and friendly now. It was such a marked change from his earlier behavior. But she noticed that the handsome man, King, remained distinctly uneasy. King turned his back to her and acted very busy, shouting at the workmen to be careful with the last of the wooden crates, which were marked Biosyn Corporation in stenciled lettering. She had the impression he was avoiding looking at her. And she still hadn't gotten a good look at the third man on deck. It made her hesitate.
You're sure it's all right?
Of course it's all right. We'd be delighted, Dodgson said. Besides, how else are you going to get there? There's no planes. The helicopter is gone.
I know. I checked.
Well, then, you know, if you want to get to the island, you'd better go with us. She looked at the jeep on the boat and said,
I think Doc must already be there with his equipment.
At the mention of that, the second man, King, snapped his head around in alarm. But Dodgson just nodded calmly and said, Yes, I think so. He left last night, I believe.
That's what he said to me.
Right. Dodgson nodded. So, he's already there. At least, I hope he is. From on deck, there were shouts in Spanish, and a captain in greasy overalls came and looked over the side. Senor Dodgson, we are ready. Good, Dodgson said. Excellent. Climb aboard, Ms. Harding. Let's get going. King. Spewing black smoke, the fishing boat chugged out of the harbor, heading toward open sea. Howard King felt the rumble of the ship's engines beneath his feet, heard the creak of the wood. He listened to the shouts of the crewmen in Spanish. King looked back at the little town of Puerto Cortez, a jumble of little houses clustered around the water's edge. He hoped this damn boat was seaworthy, because they were out in the middle of nowhere. And Dodgson was cutting corners, taking chances again. It was the situation King feared most. Howard King had known Lewis Dodgson for almost 10 years, ever since he had joined Biosyn as a young Berkeley PhD, a promising researcher with the energy to conquer the world. King had done his doctoral thesis on blood coagulation factors. He had joined Biosyn at a time of intense interest in those factors, which seemed to hold the key to dissolving clots in patients with heart attacks. There was a race among biotech companies to develop a new drug that would save lives and make a fortune as well. Initially, King worked on a promising substance called hemagglutin V5, or HGV5. In early tests, it dissolved platelet aggregation to an astonishing degree. King became the most promising young researcher at Biosyn. His picture was prominently featured in the annual report. He had his own lab and an operating budget of nearly $500,000. And then, without warning, the bottom fell out. In preliminary tests on human subjects, HGV5 failed to dissolve clots in either myocardial infarctions or pulmonary embolisms. Worse, it produced severe side effects: gastrointestinal bleeding, skin rashes, neurological problems. After one patient died from convulsions, the company halted further testing. Within weeks, King lost his lab. A newly arrived Danish researcher took it over. He was developing an extract from the saliva of the Sumatran yellow leech, which showed more promise. King moved to a smaller lab, decided he was tired of blood factors, and turned his attention to painkillers. He had an interesting compound, the L-isomer of a protein from the African horny toad, which seemed to have narcotic effects. But he had lost his former confidence, and when the company reviewed his work, they concluded that his research was insufficiently documented to warrant seeking FDA approvals for testing. His horny toad project was summarily canceled. King was then 35, and twice a failure. His picture no longer graced the annual report. It was rumored that the company would probably let him go at the next review period. When he proposed a new research project, it was rejected at once. It was a dark time in his life. Then Lewis Dodgson suggested they have lunch. Dodgson had an unsavory reputation among the researchers. He was known as the Undertaker because of the way he took over the work of others and prettied it up as his own. In earlier years, King never would have been seen with him. But now he allowed Dodgson to take him to an expensive seafood restaurant in San Francisco. "Research is hard," Dodgson said sympathetically. "You can say that again," King said. "Hard and risky," Dodgson said. "The fact is, innovative research rarely pans out." "But does management understand?" "No. If the research fails, you're the one who's blamed. It's not fair." "Tell me," King said. "But that's the name of the game." Dodgson shrugged and speared a leg of soft-shell crab. King said nothing. "Personally, I don't like risk," Dodgson continued, "and original work is risky. Most new ideas are bad, and most original work fails. That's the reality. If you feel compelled to do original research, you can't expect to fail. That's all right if you work in a university where failure is praised and success leads to ostracism. But in industry... No, no. Original work in industry is not a wise career choice. It's only going to get you into trouble. Which is where you are right now, my friend." "What can I do?" King said. "Well," Dodgson said, "I have my own version of the scientific method. I call it focused research development. If only a few ideas are going to be good, why try to find them yourself? It's too hard. Let other people find them. Let them take the risk. Let them go for the so-called glory. I'd rather wait and develop ideas that already show promise. Take what's good and make it better. Or at least... make it different enough so that I can patent it. And then I own it. Then it's mine." King was amazed at the straightforward way that Dodgson admitted he was a thief. He didn't seem in the least embarrassed. King poked at his salad for a while. "Why are you telling me this?" "Because I see something in you," Dodgson said. "I see ambition, frustrated ambition. And I'm telling you, Howard, you don't have to be frustrated. You don't even have to be fired from the company at the next performance review, which is exactly what's going to happen. How old is your kid?"
4, King said.
"Terrible to be out of work with a young family. And it won't be easy to get another job. Who's going to give you a chance now? By 35, a research scientist has already made his mark, or he's not likely to. I don't say that's right, but that's how they think." King knew that's how they thought, at every biotechnology company in California. "But Howard," Dodgson said, leaning across the table, lowering his voice, "a wonderful world awaits you if you choose to look at things differently. There's a whole other way to live your life. I really think you should consider what I'm saying." 2 weeks later, King became Dodgson's personal assistant in the Department of Future Biogenic Trends, which was how Biosyn referred to its efforts at industrial espionage. And in the years that followed, King had once again risen swiftly at Biosyn, this time because Dodgson liked him. Now King had all the accoutrements of success. A Porsche, a mortgage, a divorce, a kid he saw on weekends. All because King had proven to be the perfect second-in-command, working long hours, handling the details, keeping his fast-talking boss out of trouble. And in the process, King had come to know all the sides of Dodgson, his charismatic side, his visionary side, and his dark, ruthless side. King told himself that he could handle the ruthless side, that he could keep it in check, that over the years he had learned how to do that. But sometimes he was not so sure. Like now. Because here they were, in some rickety, stinking fishing boat, heading out into the ocean off some desolate village in Costa Rica, and in this tense moment, Dodgson had suddenly decided to play some kind of game, meeting this woman and deciding to take her along. King didn't know what Dodgson intended, but he could see the intense gleam in Dodgson's eyes that he had seen only a few times before, and it was a look that always alarmed him. The woman Harding was now up on the foredeck, standing near the bow. She was looking off at the ocean. King saw Dodgson walking around the jeep and beckoned to him nervously.
"Listen," King said, "we have to talk."
"Sure," Dodgson said easily. "What's on your mind?" And he smiled. That charming smile. Harding. Sarah Harding stared at the gray, menacing sky. The boat rolled in the heavy offshore swell. The deckhands scrambled to tie down the jeep, which threatened repeatedly to break free. She stood in the bow, fighting seasickness. On the far horizon, dead ahead, she could just see the low black line that was their first glimpse of Isla Sorna. She turned and looked back and saw Dodgson and King were huddled by the railing amidships in intense conversation. King seemed to be upset, gesticulating rapidly. Dodgson was listening and shaking his head. After a moment, he put his arm on King's shoulder. He seemed to be trying to calm the younger man down. Both men ignored the activity around the jeep. Which was odd, she thought, considering how worried they had been earlier about the equipment. Now they didn't seem to care. As for the third man, Basilton, she had, of course, recognized him, and she was surprised to find him here on this little fishing boat. Basilton had shaken her hand in a perfunctory way, and he had disappeared below decks as soon as the ship pulled away from the dock. He had not reappeared. But perhaps he was seasick, too. As she continued to watch, she saw Dodgson break away from King and hurry over to supervise the deckhands. Left alone, King went to check on the straps that lashed the boxes and barrels to the deck farther aft. The boxes marked Biosyn. Harding had never heard of the Biosyn Corporation. She wondered what connection Ian and Richard had with it. Whenever Ian was around her, he had always been critical, even contemptuous, of biotechnology companies. And these men seemed to be unlikely friends. They were too rigid, too geeky. But then, she reflected, Ian did have strange friends. They were always showing up unexpectedly at his apartment. The Japanese calligrapher, the Indonesian gamelan troupe, the Las Vegas juggler in a shiny bolero jacket, that weird French astrologer who thought the earth was hollow. And then there were his mathematician friends. They were really crazy. Or so they seemed to Sarah. They were so wild-eyed, so wrapped up in their proofs. pages and pages of proofs, sometimes hundreds of pages. It was all too abstract for her. Sarah Harding liked to touch the dirt, to see the animals, to experience the sounds and the smells. That was real to her. Everything else was just a bunch of theories, possibly right, possibly wrong. Waves began to crash over the bow, and she moved a little astern to keep dry. She yawned. She hadn't slept much in the last 24 hours. Dodgson finished working on the jeep and came over to her. She said, "Everything all right?" "Oh, yes," Dodgson said, smiling cheerfully. "Your friend King seemed upset." "He doesn't like boats," Dodgson said. He nodded to the waves. "But we're making better time. It'll only be an hour or so until we land." "Tell me," she said, "what is the Biosyn Corporation? I've never heard of it." "It's a small company," Dodgson said. "We make what are called consumer biologicals. We specialize in recreational and sports organisms. For example, we engineered new kinds of trout and other game fish. We're making new kinds of dogs, smaller pets for apartment dwellers, that sort of thing." Exactly the sort of thing that Ian hated, she thought. "How do you know Ian?" "Oh, we go way back," Dodgson said. She noticed his vagueness. "How far?" "Back to the days of the park." "The park," she said. He nodded. "Did he ever tell you how he hurt his leg?" "No," she said. "He would never talk about it. He just said it happened on a consulting job that had, I don't know, some sort of trouble." "Was it a park?" "Yes, in a way," Dodgson said, staring out at the ocean. After a moment, he shrugged. "And what about you? How do you know him?" "He was one of my thesis readers. I'm an ethologist. I study large mammals in African grassland ecosystems. East Africa. Carnivores in particular."
"Carnivores?"
"I've been studying hyenas," she said. "Before that, lions."
"For a long time?"
"Almost 10 years now. 6 years continuously since my doctorate."
"Interesting," Dodgson said, nodding. "And so did you come here all the way from Africa?"
"Yes, from Serenera, in Tanzania."
Dodgson nodded vaguely. He looked past her shoulder toward the island. "What do you know? Looks like the weather may clear after all."
She turned and saw streaks of blue in the thinning clouds overhead. The sun was trying to break through. The sea was calmer. And she was surprised to see the island was much closer. She could clearly see the cliffs rising above the seas. The cliffs were reddish-gray volcanic rock, very sheer.
"In Tanzania," Dodgson said, "you run a large research team?"
"No, I work alone."
"No students?" he said.
"I'm afraid not."
"It's because my work just isn't very glamorous. The big savanna carnivores in Africa are primarily nocturnal, so my research is mostly conducted at night."
"Must be hard on your husband."
"Oh, I'm not married," she said with a little shrug.
"I'm surprised," he said. "After all, a beautiful woman like you."
"I never had time," she said quickly. To change the subject, she said, "Where do you land on this island?"
Dodgson turned to look. They were now close enough to the island to see the waves crashing, high and white, against the base of the cliffs. They were only a mile or two away.
"It's an unusual island," Dodgson said. "This whole region of Central America is volcanic. There are something like 30 active volcanoes between Mexico and Colombia. All these offshore islands were at one time active volcanoes, part of the central chain. But unlike the mainland, the islands are now dormant. haven't erupted for 1,000 years or so.
So we're seeing the outside of the crater?
Exactly. The cliffs are all the result of erosion from rainfall, but the ocean erodes the base of the cliffs, too. Those flat sections on the cliff you see are where the ocean cut in at the bottom, and huge areas of the cliff face were undermined and just cleaved, falling straight down into the sea. It's all soft volcanic rock.
And so you land?
There are several places on the windward side where the ocean has cut caves into the cliff. And at two of those places, the caves meet rivers flowing out from the interior. So they're passable. He pointed ahead. You see there? You can just now see one of the caves. Sarah Harding saw a dark, irregular opening cut into the base of the cliff. All around it, the waves crashed, plumes of white water rising 50 feet up into the air.
You're going to take this boat into that cave there?
If the weather holds, yes. Dodgson turned away. Don't worry, it's not as bad as it looks. Anyway, you were saying about Africa. When did you leave Africa?
Right after Doc Thorne called. He said he was going with Ian to rescue Richard and asked if I wanted to come.
And what did you say?
I said I'd think about it.
Dodgson frowned. You didn't tell him you were coming?
No. Because I wasn't sure I wanted to. I mean, I'm busy. I have my work. And it's a long way.
For an old lover, Dodgson said, nodding sympathetically. She sighed.
Well, you know, Ian.
Yes, I know Ian, Dodgson said. Quite a character.
That's one way to put it, she said.
There was an awkward silence. Dodgson cleared his throat. I'm confused, he said. Who exactly did you tell you were coming here?
Nobody, she said. I just jumped on the next plane and came.
But what about your university, your colleagues?
She shrugged. There wasn't time. And as I said, I work alone.
She looked again at the island. The cliffs rose high above the boat. They were only a few hundred yards away. The cave appeared much larger now, but the waves crashed high on either side. She shook her head.
It looks pretty rough.
Don't worry, Dodgson said. See? The captain's already making for it. We'll be perfectly safe once we're passing through. And then, it should be very exciting. The boat rolled and dipped in the sea, an uncertain motion. She gripped the railing. Beside her, Dodgson grinned. See what I mean? Exciting, isn't it? He seemed suddenly energized, almost agitated. His body became tense. He rubbed his hands together. No need to worry, Ms. Harding. I can't allow anything to happen to... She didn't know what he was talking about, but before she could reply, the nose of the boat dipped again, kicking up spray, and she stumbled a little. Dodgson bent over quickly, apparently to steady her, but it seemed as if something went wrong. His body struck against her legs, then lifted, and then another wave crashed over them, and she felt her body twist, and she screamed and clutched at the railing. But it was all happening too fast. The world upended and swirled around her. Her head clanged once on the railing, and then she was tumbling, falling through space. She saw the peeling paint on the hull of the boat sliding past her. She saw the green ocean rush up toward her, and then she was shocked with the sudden, stinging cold as she plunged into the rough, heaving sea and sank beneath the waves into darkness. The Valley. This is going extremely well, Levine said, rubbing his hands together. Far beyond my expectations, I must say. I couldn't be more pleased.
He was standing in the high hide with Thorn, Eddie, Malcolm, and the kids, looking down on the valley floor below. Everyone was sweating inside the little observation hut. The midday air was still and hot. Around them, the grassy meadow was deserted. Most of the dinosaurs had moved beneath the trees into the cool of the shade. The exception was the herd of apatosaurs, which had left the trees to return to the river, where they were now drinking once again. The huge animals clustered fairly tightly around the water's edge. In the same vicinity, but more spread out, were the high-crested parasaurolophosaurs. These somewhat smaller dinosaurs positioned themselves near the apatosaur herd. Thorn wiped sweat out of his eyes and said, "Why exactly are you pleased?"
"Because of what we're seeing here," Malcolm said.
He glanced at his watch and wrote an entry in his notebook.
"We're getting the data that I hoped for. It's very exciting."
Thorn yawned, sleepy in the heat.
"Why is it exciting?"
"The dinosaurs are drinking. What's the big deal?"
"Drinking again," Levine corrected him.
"For the second time in an hour. At midday. Such fluid intake is highly suggestive of the thermoregulatory strategies these large creatures employ."
"You mean they drink a lot to stay cool," Thorn said, always impatient with jargon.
"Yes, clearly they do. Drink a lot.
But in my view, their return to the river may have another significance entirely."
"Which is?"
Come. Levine said, pointing. "Look at the herds.
Look how they are arranged spatially. We are seeing something that no one has witnessed before or even suspected for dinosaurs. We're seeing nothing less than interspecies symbiosis."
"We are?"
"Yes," Levine said. "The apatosaurs and the parasaurs are together. I saw them together yesterday, too. I'll bet that they're always together when they're out on the open plain."
"Undoubtedly, you are wondering why."
"Undoubtedly," Thorn said.
"The reason," Levine said, "is that the apatosaurs are very strong but weak-sighted, whereas the parasaurs are smaller but have very sharp vision. So the two species stay together because they provide a mutual defense. Just the way zebras and baboons stay together on the African plain. Zebras have a good sense of smell, and baboons have good eyesight. Together, they're more effective against predators than either is alone."
"And you think this is true of the dinosaurs because..."
"It's rather obvious," Levine said. "Just look at the behavior. When the two herds were alone, each clustered tightly among themselves. But when they're together, the parasaurs spread out, abandoning their former herd arrangement to form an outer ring around the apatosaurs, just as you see them now. That can only mean that individual paras are going to be protected by the apatosaur herd, and vice versa. It can only be a mutual predator defense."
As they watched, one of the parasaurs lifted its head and stared across the river. It honked mournfully, a long, musical sound. All the other parasaurs looked up and stared, too. The apatosaurs continued to drink at the river, although one or two adults raised their long necks. In the midday heat, insects buzzed around them. Thorn said, "So where are the predators?"
"Right there," Malcolm said, pointing toward a stand of trees on the other side of the river, not far from the water. Thorn looked and saw nothing.
"Don't you see them?"
"No."
"Keep looking. They're small, lizard-like animals. Dark brown."
"Raptors," he said.
Thorn shrugged. He still saw nothing. Standing beside him, Levine began to eat a power bar. Preoccupied with holding the binoculars, he dropped the wrapper on the floor of the hide. Bits of paper fluttered to the ground below.
"How are those things?" Arby said. Okay. A little sugary.
Got any more? He said.
Levine rummaged in his pockets and gave him one. Arby broke it in half and gave half to Kelly. He began to unwrap his half, carefully folding the paper, putting it neatly in his pocket.
You realize this is all highly significant, Malcolm said. For the question of extinction?
Already it's obvious that the extinction of the dinosaurs is a far more complex problem than anyone has recognized.
It is? Arby said.
Well, consider, Malcolm said. All extinction theories are based on the fossil record. But the fossil record doesn't show the sort of behavior we're seeing here. It doesn't record the complexity of groups interacting.
Because fossils are just bones, Arby said.
Right. And bones are not behavior. When you think about it, the fossil record is like a series of photographs. Frozen moments from what is really a moving, ongoing reality. Looking at the fossil record is like thumbing through a family photo album. You know that the album isn't complete. You know life happens between the pictures. But you don't have any record of what happens in between. You only have the pictures. So you study them and study them. And pretty soon you begin to think of the album not as a series of moments, but as reality itself. And you begin to explain everything in terms of the album, and you forget the underlying reality. And the tendency, Malcolm said, has been to think in terms of physical events. To assume that some external physical event caused the extinctions. A meteor hits the earth and changes the weather. Or volcanoes erupt and change the weather. Or a meteor causes the volcanoes to erupt and change the weather. Or vegetation changes and species starve and become extinct. Or a new disease arises and species become extinct. Or a new plant arises and poisons all the dinosaurs. In every case, what is imagined is some external event. But what nobody imagines is that the animals themselves might have changed. Not in their bones, but their behavior. Yet when you look at animals like these and see how intricately their behavior is interrelated, you realize that a change in group behavior could easily lead to extinction.
But why would group behavior change? Thorne said.
If there wasn't some external catastrophe to force it, why should the behavior change?
Actually, Malcolm said, behavior is always changing, all the time. Our planet is a dynamic, active environment. Weather is changing. The land is changing. Continents drift. Oceans rise and fall. Mountains thrust up and erode away. All the organisms on the planet are constantly adapting to those changes. The best organisms are the ones that can adapt most rapidly. That's why it's hard to see how a catastrophe that produces a large change could cause extinction, since so much change is occurring all the time anyway.
In that case, Thorne said, what causes extinction?
Certainly not rapid change alone, Malcolm said. The facts tell us that clearly.
What facts?
After every major environmental change, a wave of extinctions has usually followed, but not right away. Extinctions only occur thousands or millions of years later. Take the last glaciation in North America. The glaciers descended. The climate changed severely, but animals didn't die. Only after the glaciers receded, when you'd think things would go back to normal, did lots of species become extinct. That's when giraffes and tigers and mammoths vanished on this continent. And that's the usual pattern. It's almost as if species are weakened by the major change, but die off later. It's a well-recognized phenomenon.
It's called softening up the beachhead, Levine said.
And what's the explanation for it?
Levine was silent.
There is none, Malcolm said. It's a paleontological mystery.
But I believe that complexity theory has a lot to tell us about it.
Because if the notion of life at the edge of chaos is true, then major change pushes animals closer to the edge. It destabilizes all sorts of behavior. And when the environment goes back to normal, it's not really a return to normal. In evolutionary terms, it's another big change, and it's just too much to keep up with. I believe that new behavior in populations can emerge in unexpected ways. And I think I know why the dinosaurs...
What's that? Thorn said.
Thorn was looking at the trees and saw a single dinosaur hop out into view. It was rather slender, agile on its hind legs, balancing with a stiff tail. It was 6 feet tall, green-brown with dark red stripes, like a tiger. That, Malcolm said, is a velociraptor. Thorn turned to Levine.
That's what chased you up in the tree?
It looks ugly.
Efficient, Levine said. Those animals are brilliantly constructed killing machines.
Arguably the most efficient predators in the history of the planet.
The one that just stepped out will be the alpha animal.
It leads the pack. Thorn saw other movement beneath the trees.
There's more.
Oh, yes, Levine said. This particular pack is very large.
He picked up binoculars and peered through them.
I'd like to locate their nest, he said.
I haven't been able to find it anywhere on the island.
Of course, they're secretive, but even so.
The pterosaurs were all crying loudly, moving closer to the apatosaur herd as they did so. But the big apatosaurs seemed relatively indifferent. The adults nearest the water actually turned their backs to the approaching raptor.
Don't they care? Arby said. They're not even looking at him.
Don't be fooled, Levine said. The apatosaurs care very much. They may look like gigantic cows, but they're nothing of the sort. Those whiptails are 30 or 40 feet long and weigh several tons. Notice how fast they can swing them. One smack from those tails would snap an attacker's back.
So turning away is part of their defense?
Unquestionably, yes. And you can see now how the long necks balance their tails.
The tails of the adults were so long they reached entirely across the river to the other shore.
End of Disc 6. Disc 7.
The tails of the adults were so long they reached entirely across the river to the other shore. As they swung back and forth and the pterosaurs cried out, the lead raptor turned away. Moments later, the entire pack began to slink off, following the edge of the trees, heading up into the hills.
Looks like you're right, Thorn said. The tails scared them off.
How many do you count? Levine said.
I don't know. 10 to 12? I might have missed a few.
14. Malcolm scribbled in his notebook.
You want to follow them? Levine said.
Not now.
We could take the Explorer.
Maybe later, Malcolm said.
I think we need to know where their nest is, Levine said. It's essential, Ian, if we're going to settle predator-prey relationships. Nothing is more important than that. And this is a perfect opportunity to follow.
Maybe later, Malcolm said. He checked his watch again.
That's the 100th time you've checked your watch today, Thorn said.
Malcolm shrugged.
Getting to be lunchtime, he said.
By the way, what about Sarah?
Shouldn't she be arriving soon?
Yes.
I imagine she'll show up any time now, Thorn said.
Malcolm wiped his forehead.
It's hot up here.
Yes, it's hot.
They listened to the buzzing of insects in the midday sun and watched the raptors retreat.
You know, I'm thinking, Malcolm said, maybe we ought to go back.
Go back? Levine said. Now?
What about our observations? What about the other cameras we want to place and...
I don't know. Maybe it'd be good to take a break.
Levine stared at him in disbelief. He said nothing. Thorne and the kids looked at Malcolm silently.
"Well, it seems to me," Malcolm said, "that if Sarah's coming all the way from Africa, we should be there to greet her."
He shrugged.
"I think it's simple politeness."
Thorne said,
"I didn't realize that,
No, no, Malcolm said quickly. "It's nothing like that. I just,
You know, maybe she's not even coming."
He looked suddenly uncertain.
"Did she say she was coming?"
"She said she'd think about it." Malcolm frowned.
"Then she's coming.
If Sarah said that, she's coming.
I know her.
So, what do you say? Want to go back?"
"Certainly not," Levine said, peering through binoculars. "I wouldn't dream of leaving here now."
Malcolm turned. "Doc, want to go back?"
"Sure," Thorne said, wiping his forehead.
"It's hot."
"If I know Sarah," Malcolm said, climbing down the scaffolding, "she's going to show up on this island just looking great."
Cave. She struggled upward and her head broke the surface, but she saw only water. Great swells rising 15 feet above her on all sides. The power of the ocean was immense. The surge dragged her forward, then back, and she was helpless to resist. She could not see the boat anywhere, only foaming sea on all sides. She could not see the island, only water. Only water. She fought a sense of overwhelming panic. She tried to kick against the current, but her boots were leaden. She sank down again and struggled back, gasping for air. She had to get her boots off somehow. She gulped a breath and ducked her head under the water and tried to unlace the boots. Her lungs burned as she fumbled with the knots. The ocean swept her back and forth ceaselessly. She got one boot off, gulped air, and ducked down again. Her fingers were stiff with cold and fright as she worked on the other boot. It seemed to take hours. Finally, her legs were free, light, and she dog-paddled, catching her breath. The surge lifted her high, dropped her again. She could not see the island. She felt panic again. She turned and felt the surge lift once more. And then she saw the island. The sheer cliffs were close, frighteningly close. The waves boomed as they smashed against the rocks. She was no more than 50 yards offshore, being swept inexorably toward the crashing surf. On the next crest, she saw the cave, 100 yards to her right. She tried to swim toward it, but it was hopeless. She had no power at all to move in this gigantic surf. She felt only the strength of the sea sweeping her to the cliffs. Panic made her heart race. She knew she would be instantly killed. A wave crested over her. She gulped seawater and coughed. Her eyes blurred. She felt nausea and deep, deep terror. She put her head down and began to swim, arm over arm, kicking as hard as she could. She had no sense of movement, only the sideways pull of the surge. She dared not look up. She kicked harder. When she raised her head for another breath, she saw she had moved a little. Not much, but a little, to the north. She was a little nearer to the cave. She was encouraged, but she was terrified. She had so little strength. Her arms and legs ached with her effort. Her lungs burned. Her breath came in short, ragged, heaving gasps. She coughed again, grabbed another breath, put her head down, and kicked onward. Even with her head in the water, she heard the deep boom of the surf against the cliffs. She kicked with all her might. The currents and surge moved her left and right, forward and back. It was hopeless, but still she tried. Gradually, the ache in her muscles became a steady, dull pain.
She felt she had lived with this pain all her life. She did not notice it anymore. She kicked on, oblivious. When she felt the surge lift her up again, she raised her head for a breath. She was startled to see that the cave was very close. A few more strokes and she would be swept inside it. She had thought the current might be less severe around the cave, but it wasn't. On either side of the opening, the waves crashed high, climbing the cliff walls and then falling back. The boat was nowhere in sight. She ducked her head down again, kicked forward, using the last of her strength. She could feel her entire body weakening. She could not last much longer. She knew she was being carried toward the cliffs. She heard the boom of the surf louder now, and she kicked again, and suddenly a huge swell swept her up, lifting her, carrying her toward the cliffs. She was powerless to resist it. She raised her head to look and saw darkness, inky darkness. In her exhaustion and pain, she realized that she was inside the cave. She had been swept into the cave. The booming sound was hollow, reverberating. It was too dark to see the walls on either side. The current was intense, sweeping her ever deeper. She gasped for breath and paddled ineffectually. Her body scraped against rock. She felt a moment of searing pain, and then she was swept farther into the depths of the cave. But now there was a difference. She saw faint light on the ceiling, and the water around her seemed to glow. The surge lessened. She found it easier to keep her head above water. She saw hot light ahead, brilliantly hot. The end of the cave. And suddenly, astonishingly, she was carried through and burst into sunlight and open air. She found herself in the middle of a broad, muddy river, surrounded by dense green foliage. The air was hot and still. She heard the distant cries of jungle birds. Up ahead, around a bend in the river, she saw the stern of Dodgson's boat already tied up to the shore. She could not see any of the people, and she didn't want to see them. Summoning her remaining strength, she kicked toward shore and clutched at a stand of mangroves, growing thickly along the water's edge. Too weak to hold on, she hooked her arm around a root and lay on her back in the gentle current, looking up at the sky, gasping for breath. She did not know how much time passed, but finally she felt strong enough to haul herself arm over arm along the mangrove roots at the water's edge until she came to a narrow break in the foliage, leading to a patch of muddy shore beyond. As she dragged herself out of the water and up on the slippery bank, she noticed several rather large animal footprints in the mud. They were curious, three-toed footprints, with each toe ending in a large claw. She bent to examine them more closely, and then she felt the earth vibrating, trembling beneath her hands. A large shadow fell over her, and she looked up in astonishment at the leathery, pale underbelly of an enormous animal. She was too weak to react, even to raise her head. The last thing she saw was a huge leathery foot landing beside her, squishing in the mud and a soft snorting sound. And then suddenly, abruptly, exhaustion overtook her, and Sarah Harding collapsed and fell onto her back. Her eyes rolled up into her head, and she lost consciousness. Dodgson. A few yards up from the shore of the river, Lewis Dodgson climbed into the custom-made Jeep Wrangler and slammed the door shut. Beside him in the passenger seat, Howard King was wringing his hands. He said, "How could you have done that to her?" "Done what?" George Basilton said from the back seat. Dodgson did not reply. He turned the key in the ignition. The engine rumbled to life. He popped the four-wheel drive into gear and headed up the hill into the jungle, away from the boat at the shore.
"How could you?" King said again, agitated. "I mean, do Jesus!
What happened was an accident, Dodgson said.
An accident? An accident?
That's right. An accident, Dodgson said calmly. She fell overboard.
I didn't see anything, Basilton said.
King was shaking his head.
Jesus, what if somebody comes to investigate and...
What if they do? Dodgson said, interrupting him. We were in rough seas. She was standing at the bow. A big wave hit us and she was washed overboard. She couldn't swim very well. We circled and looked for her, but there was no hope. A very unfortunate accident. So what are you concerned about?
What am I concerned about?
Yes, Howard. Exactly what the fuck are you concerned about?
I saw it, for Christ's sake.
No, you didn't, Dodgson said.
I didn't see anything, Basilton said. I was down below the whole time.
That's fine for you, Howard King said. But what if there's an investigation?
The jeep bounced up the dirt track, moving deeper into the jungle. There won't be, Dodgson said. She left Africa in a hurry, and she didn't tell anybody where she was going.
How do you know? King whined.
Because she told me, Howard. That's how I know. Now get the map out and stop moaning. You knew the deal when you joined me.
I didn't know you were going to kill somebody, for Christ's sake.
Howard, Dodgson said with a sigh, nothing's going to happen. Get the map out.
How do you know? King said.
Because I know what I'm doing, Dodgson said. That's why. Unlike Malcolm and Thorne, who are somewhere on this island, screwing around, doing fuck knows what in this damn jungle. Mention of the others caused a new worry. Fretting, King said,
maybe we'll run into them.
No, Howard, we won't. They'll never even know we're here. We're only going to be on this island for 4 hours, remember? Land at 1, back on the boat by 5, back at the port by 7, back in San Francisco by midnight. Bang. Done. Finito. And finally, after all these years, I'll have what I should have had long ago.
Dinosaur embryos, Basilton said.
Embryos? King asked, surprised.
Oh, I'm not interested in embryos anymore, Dodgson said. Years ago I tried to get frozen embryos, but there's no reason to bother with embryos now.
I want fertilized eggs. And in 4 hours, I'll have them from every species on this island.
How can you do that in 4 hours?
Because I already know the precise location of every dinosaur breeding site on the island. The map, Howard.
King opened the map. It was a large topographical chart of the island, 2 feet by 3 feet, showing terrain elevations in blue contours. At several places in lowland valleys, there were dense red concentric circles. In some places, clusters of circles.
What's this? King said.
Why don't you read what it says? Dodgson said. King turned the map and looked at the legend.
Sigma Data Landsat Nordstat Mixed Spectra VSFR FASLR IFFVR. And then a bunch of numbers.
No, wait. Dates.
Correct, Dodgson said. Dates.
Past dates?
This is a summary chart? Combining data from several satellite passes? Correct. King frowned.
And it looks like visible spectrum and false aperture radar and...
What? Infrared. Broadband thermal VR. Dodgson smiled. I did all this in about 2 hours. Downloaded all the satellite data, summarized it, and had the answers I wanted.
I get it, King said. These red circles are infrared signatures.
Yes, Dodgson said. Big animals leave big signatures. I got all the satellite flybys over this island for the last few years and mapped the location of heat sources. And the locations overlapped from pass to pass, which is what makes these red concentric marks, meaning that the animals tend to be located in these particular places.
Why?
He turned to King. Because these are the nesting sites.
Yes. They must be, Basilton said.
Maybe that's where they eat, King said.
Dodgson shook his head irritably. Obviously, those circles can't be feeding sites.
Why not?
Because these animals average 20 tons apiece, that's why. You get a herd of 20-ton dinos, and you're talking a combined biomass of more than 500,000 pounds moving through the forest. That many big animals are going to eat a lot of plant matter in the course of a day. And the only way they can do that is by moving. Right?
I guess.
You guess? Look around you, Howard. Do you see any denuded sections of forest?
No, you don't.
They eat a few leaves from the trees and move on. Trust me. These animals have to move to eat. But what they don't move is their nesting sites. So these red circles must be nesting sites. He glanced at the map. And unless I'm wrong, the first of the nests is just over this rise and down the hill on the other side. The jeep fishtailed in a patch of mud and ground forward, lurching up the hill.
Mating calls. Richard Levine stood in the high hide, staring at the herds through binoculars. Malcolm had gone back to the trailer with the others, leaving Levine alone. In fact, Levine was relieved to have him gone. Levine was quite content to make observations on these extraordinary animals, and he was aware that Malcolm did not share his boundless enthusiasm. Indeed, Malcolm always seemed to have other considerations on his mind, and Malcolm was notably impatient with the act of observation. He wanted to analyze the data, but he did not want to collect it. Of course, among scientists, that represented a well-known difference in personality. Physics was a perfect example. The experimentalists and the theorists lived in utterly different worlds, passing papers back and forth, but sharing little else in common. It was almost as if they were in different disciplines. And for Levine and Malcolm, the difference in their approach had surfaced early, back in the Santa Fe days. Both men were interested in extinction, but Malcolm approached the subject broadly, from a purely mathematical standpoint. His detachment, his inexorable formulas had fascinated Levine, and the two men began an informal exchange over frequent lunches. Levine taught Malcolm paleontology. Malcolm taught Levine nonlinear mathematics. They began to draw some tentative conclusions which both found exciting. But they also began to disagree. More than once they were asked to leave the restaurant. Then they would go out into the heat of Guadalupe Street and walk back toward the river, still shouting at each other while approaching tourists hurried to the other side of the street. In the end, their differences came down to personalities. Malcolm considered Levine pedantic and fussy, preoccupied with petty details. Levine never saw the big picture. He never looked at the consequences of his actions. For his own part, Levine did not hesitate to call Malcolm imperious and detached, indifferent to details. God is in the details, Levine once reminded him.
Maybe your God, Malcolm shot back. Not mine. Mine is in the process.
Standing in the high hide, Levine thought that answer was exactly what you would expect from a mathematician. Levine was quite satisfied that details were everything, at least in biology, and that the most common failing of his biological colleagues was insufficient attention to detail. For himself, Levine lived for the details, and he could not ever let them go. Like the animal that had attacked him with Diego. Levine thought of it often, turning it over and over again, reliving the events. Because there was something troubling, some impression that he could not get right. The animal had attacked quickly, and he had sensed it was a basic theropod form. Hind legs, stiff tail, large skull, the usual. But in the brief flash in which he had seen the creature, there seemed to be a peculiarity around the orbits, which made him think of Cornotaurus sastrae from the Goro Friga formation in Argentina. And in addition, the skin was extremely unusual. It seemed to be a sort of bright mottled green, but there was something about it. He shrugged. The troubling idea hung in the back of his mind, but he couldn't get to it. He just couldn't get it. Reluctantly, Levine turned his attention to the pterosaur herd, browsing by the river alongside the apatosaurs. He listened as the pterosaurs made their distinctive, low trumpeting sounds. Levine noticed that most often the pterosaurs made a sound of short duration, a kind of rumbling honk. Sometimes, several animals made this sound at once, or very nearly overlapping, so it seemed to be an audible way of indicating to the herd where all the members were. Then there was a much longer, more dramatic trumpeting call. This sound was made infrequently, and only by the two largest animals in the herd, which raised their heads and trumpeted loud and long. But what did the sound mean? Standing there in the hot sun, Levine decided to perform a little experiment. He cupped his hands around his mouth and imitated the pterosaur's trumpeting cry. It wasn't a very good imitation, but immediately the lead pterosaur looked up, turning its head this way and that, and it gave a low cry, answering Levine. Levine gave a second call. Again, the pterosaur answered. Levine was pleased by this response and made an entry in his notebook. But when he looked up again, he was surprised to see that the pterosaur herd was drifting away from the apatosaurs. They collected together, formed a single line, and began to walk directly toward the high hide. Levine started to sweat. What had he done? In some bizarre corner of his mind, he wondered if he had imitated a mating cry. That was all he needed to attract a randy dinosaur. Who knew how these animals behaved in mating? With growing anxiety, he watched them march forward. Probably he should call Malcolm and ask his advice. But as he thought about it, he realized that by imitating that cry, he had interfered with the environment, introduced a new variable. He had done exactly what he had told Thorne he did not intend to do. It was thoughtless, of course, and surely not very important in the scheme of things, but Malcolm was certain to give him hell about it. Levine lowered his binoculars and stared. A deep, trumpeting sound reverberated through the air, so loud it hurt his ears. The ground began to shake, making the high hide sway back and forth precariously. My God, he thought. They're coming right for me. He bent over and with fumbling fingers searched his backpack for the radio. Problems of Evolution. In the trailer, Thorne took the rehydrated meals out of the microwave and passed the plates around the little table. Everyone unwrapped them and began to eat. Malcolm poked his fork into the food,
What is this stuff?
Herb-baked chicken breast, Thorne said. Malcolm took a bite and shook his head.
Isn't technology wonderful? He said. They managed to make it taste just like cardboard.
Malcolm looked at the two kids seated opposite him, who were eating energetically. Kelly glanced up at him and gestured with her fork at the books strapped into a shelf beside the table.
One thing I don't understand.
Only one? Malcolm said.
All this business about evolution, she said.
Darwin wrote his book a long time ago, right?
Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, Malcolm said.
And by now everybody believes it, isn't that right?
I think it's fair to say that every scientist in the world agrees that evolution is a feature of life on Earth, Malcolm said. And that we are descended from animal ancestors,
yes.
Okay, Kelly said. So, what's the big deal now?
Malcolm smiled.
The big deal, he said, is that everybody agrees evolution occurs, but nobody understands how it works. There are big problems with the theory, and more scientists are admitting it.
Malcolm pushed his plate away.
You have to track the theory, he said, over a couple of hundred years. Start with Baron Georges Cuvier, the most famous anatomist in the world in his day, living in the intellectual center of the world, Paris. Around 1800, people began digging up old bones, and Cuvier realized that they belonged to animals no longer found on Earth. That was a problem, because back in 1800, everybody believed that all the animal species ever created were still alive. The idea seemed reasonable because the Earth was thought to be only a few thousand years old, and because God, who had created all the animals, would never let any of his creations become extinct. So extinction was agreed to be impossible. Cuvier agonized over these dug-up bones, but he finally concluded that God or no God, many animals had become extinct. As a result, he thought, of worldwide catastrophes, like Noah's flood.
Okay.
So Cuvier reluctantly came to believe in extinction, Malcolm said, but he never accepted evolution. In Cuvier's mind, evolution didn't occur. Some animals died and some survived, but none evolved. In his view, animals didn't change. Then along came Darwin, who said that animals did evolve, and that the dug-up bones were actually the extinct predecessors of living animals. The implications of Darwin's idea upset lots of people. They didn't like to think of God's creations changing, and they didn't like to think of monkeys in their family trees. It was embarrassing and offensive. The debate was fierce. But Darwin amassed a tremendous amount of factual data. He had made an overwhelming case. So gradually, his idea of evolution was accepted by scientists and by the world at large. But the question remained, how does evolution happen? For that, Darwin didn't have a good answer.